Hello and welcome to Subject to Change with me, Russell Hogg. My guest today is historian Mike Dash. Mike has been on the podcast before when he talked about the wreck of the Batavia and the extraordinary and violent events which accompanied it. But this time we're going to talk about something much more peaceful, which is tulip mania in the Dutch Republic back in the 1600s. So welcome, Mike, to the podcast.
Thank you.
So we're going to be talking about tulip mania, and of course we associate tulips completely now with the Dutch. But do you want to maybe start and just talk a bit about how that plant came to be in the Dutch Republic? Because it wasn't a native to that area, was it?
Well, it wasn't, and that's a very important datum, really. I mean, in terms of explaining why the tulip mania happened, it's completely vital. I'll go into some detail as to why that is. The tulip, so far as we know, began its life in a mountain range called the Tian Shan, which separates China and Afghanistan. So a fairly remote part of the world. It's quite a high range of mountains, goes up to sort of 17, 20,000 feet, and it's very snowy. For the local people who lived there, the nomadic Turkic tribes, the tulip was an important symbol. It was a symbol of spring in the same way that we in the UK might have the snowdrop as a symbol. When the tulips poked through the snow and began to bloom, it was a sign that, you know, the bad weather for the year, the harshness was over and there'd be a more fertile period. And so it was something which was very important to the local people. And as they nomadically moved with them, they used to take the tulip with them. And that seems to be how it began to make its way west. And it moved west probably from maybe the 7th or 8th centuries AD. And we can trace its passage by the way in which it appears in the various records that exist in the societies that it passed through, a lot of which are kind of literary or poetic, actually, because it continued to be an important symbol. So, for example, you know, it reached Persia around about the year 1000, and there it was absolutely something which was an important way of showing your love for somebody. If you were in love with a young girl, you would give her a tulip, and the idea was that the red on the leaves symbolised the burning passion in your heart that you had for this favourite person, and the black base of the flower itself showed that your heart was burned to a coal with its desire for her. By the time that the tulip reached the Ottoman Empire, another very important Turkic polity, it was probably 12 or 1300. The Ottomans were engaged at that point with reducing what was left of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, as we also call it, and had begun their advance into Europe. And when they took Constantinople in 1453 and began to set up a substantial new polity based in Constantinople, again, the tulip was an important symbol for them. It was a flower which was specifically valued by the Ottoman elite and the sultans. And they grew it in what they called paradise gardens. And these were very different to the sort of formal Western gardens that were laid out in the same sort of period, where regimentation and sort of straight lines of trees and flowers and so on were the order of the day. The Ottoman Paradise Garden was a reflection of paradise. It was what heaven would be like when you got there. And the wildness and the profusion of nature was important to them because it showed, you know, what a creative, fertile, bountiful God there was to look forward to being reunited with. And so in the same way as it had been in the mountains of Tian Shan, in the same way as it had been in Isfahan and in Persia, the tulip became a symbol of this new Ottoman society, and it drew attention because it was an important symbol in an important polity.
Slightly more down to earth, did they not at one stage embroider the tulip on the inside of their underwear? Do I remember somebody?
Well, they did. I mean, Sultan Bayezid, who was one of the most powerful of the Ottoman sultans, did this. I mean, this whole issue is quite a significant one in Islam, because there is a prescription, strictly speaking, in Islam against the portrayal of any living thing on the grounds that, you know, a mere human cannot really convey the magnificence of one of God's creations. And so, absolutely, it had to be displayed on underwear because you couldn't wear it externally as a symbol. It would attract all sorts of disapproving glances and religious religious prescriptions. But that didn't stop all Islamic people from using images. They would just be used in this slightly more private way. And And so to put a tulip on an Ottoman sultan's underwear is sort of combining the two things. It's showing something which is an important symbol of the Ottoman Sultanate, and it's also hiding it because it is prescribed by Sharia law.
And then I think there's some dispute about how it actually gets into Western Europe. I think somebody said, oh, the ambassador takes it to Clusius, the great botanist or something like that. But I think you're a bit skeptical that we actually know how it manages to get there.
I don't dispute that that's probably one of the routes. I think that there's no particular reason to assume it needs to be a single event because the tulip was such a prominent symbol, and plenty of Westerners found their way to Constantinople and had dealings with the Ottomans because they were powerful and because they had to. I mean, there were ambassadors from most Western countries, the French, as well as the Holy Roman Empire, the Spaniards, the English and so on. They all had ambassadors there. And then there were merchants and so on traveling to and fro. But yes, I mean, yeah, the basic story is that in the middle of the 16th century, Busbeck, who was the ambassador of the Holy Roman Emperor, who was based in Vienna, sent some tulip bulbs back as part of his sort of diplomatic baggage, in the diplomatic pouch, so to speak, as one of the sort of curiosities of the Ottoman Empire, as something which, you know, people needed to understand if they were going to understand the Ottomans. And those tulips were planted and cultivated in what's now South Germany, particularly around Augsburg. And that appears to be the first time that we can say for sure that tulips made their appearance inside Germany. So, at this point, we probably need to sort of say something a little bit about the way in which the tulip was being grown and cultivated at this time. The Ottomans, as a powerful empire which loved nature, did cultivate the tulip in a formal way. They had a lot of professional gardeners. The people who ran these paradise gardens, planted and tended them, were expert gardeners, and they did cultivate it in such a way as to actually change it. So the original flowers that had been grown in the Tian Shan were very simple, unicolored flowers. They had red petals, usually just simple red petals. The Ottomans, by a process of trial and error, because fundamentally neither they nor anybody else at that time understood the biology of the tulip, managed to create a new variety of flower, which is called the Istanbul tulip. It doesn't exist anymore. It's been sort of bred out of existence, but the pictures do. And it was a really extraordinary flower. It had a sort of almond-shaped set of petals. You know, the petals formed a sort of almond shape in the round. And each of the ends of the petals was greatly extended to a sort of sharp dagger-like point. So quite unlike the sorts of tulips you would buy in a supermarket today. I think that probably helped to make them attractive and unique and strange to Europeans, and probably helped Busbeck decide he wanted to pass them on. But the second thing to say about the tulip is that it really is a flower that's difficult to grow. I mean, if you grow it from its seed, it takes about 7 years from the original planting to being a flower that will produce a bulb that can then reproduce. If you try and grow it from bulb, which is obviously quicker, I mean, it only takes a year, the bulb itself would usually only grow one or two what are called offsets. So these are little sort of miniature bulbs that you can break off and are viable as sort of separate plants of their own. So actually multiplying any tulips that you grow is a very, very long, slow and tedious and hazardous business. And so the first thing to say about the tulip as it arrives in Europe is that it is extremely rare and it's extremely difficult to increase its supply so that it ceases to become rare. The second thing to say about it, and we don't know exactly when this happened, is that it acquired a virus. The virus is called the tobacco mosaic virus, but it has a particular effect on tulips. It has two particular effects on tulips. It weakens them, as many viruses do, but it also makes them vastly more colourful. Somehow, the mosaic virus works on the genetics of the plant in such a way that when it blooms, the colours are dramatically more vivid. And simply colourful than any normal flower. Now, again, I mean, because tulips were infected with a disease that weakened them, this tobacco mosaic virus has also been bred out of the flowers. And that's happened since the 1820s. So when we look at tulips today, it's quite important to remember that they are a sort of pale simulacrum of the sorts of tulips that caused the famous Dutch tulip mania of the 17th century.
It is quite ironic, isn't it, that the thing that makes them so beautiful is the thing which you simply can't have with them because after a few generations, they just stop working, don't they?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it deeply symbolic. One could write a novel about it. but yes, I mean, you're right. I mean, if you allow the flower to go on like that, it will weaken and eventually cease to reproduce. And in the meantime, I mean, the other thing, which, you know, the lack of understanding of botany meant was that, you know, even the most expert gardeners in Europe didn't really understand how to reproduce tulips in, you know, in such a way that they would be consistent. So the mosaic virus has the effect that it will sometimes cause the tulip to change colour. And so a tulip which has been broken off from a bulb, which is, you know, a red and white tulip, might turn into something completely different. And this unpredictability and the ability of the tulip to change, to mutate, is also one of the key factors that underpins the way in which the tulip mania period of its history develops.
Speaking of gardeners, the man Clusius, he was given the garden of the Habsburg emperor, although I'm not sure he ever actually got round to building it. It doesn't seem like they were very keen.
He was famous. I mean, he was the gardener in Europe in the late 16th century, 1570s, 1580s, 1590s. He was based in the Netherlands. His main job was running the botanical gardens at the University of Leiden, which is the Dutch equivalent of Oxford or Cambridge. And his fame spread from there in such a way that, yes, he was invited by the Emperor Rudolf II, the well-known alchemist, to go and run the equivalent botanic gardens in Vienna. As you say, he didn't take up that role, but, I mean, he did continue to run the hortus, the garden at Leiden. And that is where, really, the tulip sort of begins to come into its own. I mean, it moved from Augsburg in the 1550s. It was present in what's now Belgium, the southern Netherlands, it was then, and in the northern provinces, which were in revolt against Spain at this point and engaged in a, you know, fairly large, long-term, 80-year-long war for Dutch independence. It's really when it comes into Clusius' hands that it's grown in a much more systematic way. Now, the thing to say about Clusius is that he was a humanist. I mean, the fact that he's called Carolus Clusius would tell us that. It's a Latinized name, and this was one of the ways in which humanist scholars distinguished themselves. They would take a name and Latinize it to show that they were scholars and to show that they were devotees of the sort of, you know, the Renaissance view that Christianity and the Bible was not the only thing that mattered, and that we could learn lessons from, you know, ancient civilizations, Greece, Rome, and so on. And the humanist group in Europe was very heavily interconnected. They would write letters to each other and send each other things. And so the fact that Clusius was growing flowers in his hortus in Leiden didn't necessarily mean that they were restricted to the hortus in Leiden. He would send out bulbs to sort of favored correspondents. And so, you know, the flowers that he grew began to spread from there. And because he was a keen botanist and experimenter and had access to all sorts of resources at this garden, he grew more and different varieties of tulip than anybody else.
And did people not jump over his garden wall from time to time and sort of make off with a sack full?
Yes. I mean, so this is an interesting point. I mean, you know, the spread of the tulip is not controlled. There were at least two occasions when the walls at the hortus were breached and people clambered over them and deliberately stole, I mean, specifically tulip bulbs, which is one of the first signs we have that they are being regarded as something that's very different, not just in terms of their beauty or their botany, but in terms of their value as well. And, you know, the contemporary chronicles say, you know, it was in this manner that the seven provinces of North Holland, the North Netherlands, were populated with tulips. So that's in the period in the 1590s, maybe the early 1600s. And so by the time we get into, you know, the beginnings of what is, in fact, the Dutch Golden Age, which begins really with the formation of the Dutch East India Company, the company that sent the Batavia, which we talked about last time, off to the East Indies in search of spice. That trade, the spice trade, was the primary luxury trade of the time, the most profitable one. And the Dutch Golden Age begins with this sort of gigantic, it's hard to, again, to exaggerate how much is involved, the gigantic influx of money into the Netherlands. And again, the tulip is in the right place at the right time from this point of view, because the Dutch society is a very peculiar society from that point of view. It is not one, in a sense, that welcomes money for the sake of money. For a start, most Dutch people by this time were Calvinist. So there were very strict prescriptions, actually, on how you could display your wealth. It was not the done thing to spend it on rich jewels, fancy furs, fast living, or anything like that. One of the very few things you could do if you were one of the newly rich merchants who owned shares in the Dutch East India Company was you could use that money to sort of, you know, reflect the glory of God. And what that really boiled down to was it was okay to buy an expensive country estate and use that as a place to sort of cultivate flowers in, because flowers are one of God's creations. To cultivate these beautiful flowers is a reflection of the bounty of God and God's power.
That's quite amusing, because that's actually a direct reflection of what the Ottomans would have viewed it as.
Very similar, exactly. So the first people in the Netherlands outside the sort of academic circles that Clusius moved in, who were serious about growing the flowers, were the richest people in the country. And they employed professional gardeners to cultivate their flower gardens at their fancy country houses. And they had a sort of informal competition going as to who could grow the rarest and the most beautiful of flowers. And so it's at this point that the tulip becomes sort of graded for the first time. The gardeners who were responsible for this would sort of look at these flowers, and they decided that the rarest ones, the most beautiful ones, were the, and again, I guess this fits the religious thing, doesn't it? The most modest ones, in a sense. They're the ones that have white petals and just a tiny few flecks and flares of this super bright colour that we were talking about. So the rarest of the flowers were what were called superfine rosen tulips. And rosen means that they're white, have white petals with a very small flecks and flares, bright scarlet running right down the middle of the petal and around the edges. The rarest of all of those flowers was a flower called Semper Augustus. And we know about this because a contemporary chronicler wrote a little bit about it without naming the owner explicitly. He said that one of these Dutch regents, that's the name given to the sort of ruling class in the Netherlands, who was a merchant, owned a garden at his country house which had 12 of these Semper Augustus flowers. And these were the only ones that existed in the world. And because they were so rare and so beautiful, his friends tried to persuade him to sell them. And this is really where we first get some sort of information about how much these tulips are valued at, because the various offers that came in over the years, build up and up until we're talking about offers of 10,000-12,000 guilders. This is at a time when a whole family in the Netherlands could live on an annual income of about 300 guilders. So we're talking 12,000 guilders is a lot of money, even for a regent. But the guy who controlled them refused adamantly to sell them. They were worth more to him as something that he controlled fundamentally. And so, demand starts to spread down from the very, very finest flowers to something which is maybe a tiny bit less rare. So, the classification that existed at this time is worth going into a tiny bit. The rosen tulips were the most sought after, and then the second most sought after were called violettin. So they were very similar. They had white petals, but with purple flares and flames of colour. And then there was a third and slightly less in-demand group called the Bizarden, and they had yellow petals with red flares and flames of colour on them. So there were three different groups, and in each one of these, the sort of pattern of the petals is determines whether or not the plant is sufficiently different for another to be considered a unique variety. And they started giving them all sorts of fancy names, and normally the names reflected how rare they were. So you'd have a tulip called Alexander the Great, or General of Generals, or some sort of huge, high-polluting word that suggests it's better.
Did they ever name them after themselves?
I'm not sure that they did a lot of that. I mean, certainly there are some examples of people having flowers named after them. But again, I mean, it's kind of infradig if you're a Calvinist merchant, yes, to do that. Actually, you want something which is a bit more kind of historical.
But still, they're still rare, aren't they, tulips, because they don't reproduce fast enough. And I'm sure I read in your book about somebody who'd artfully arranged some mirrors in his garden.
Yes. I mean, well, and this is symptomatic, isn't it? I mean, if the richest people in the world, effectively at this time, cannot afford enough tulips to populate an entire garden and have to create these weird sort of mirror devices, you plonk it down in the middle of the flower bed, you plant the tulips in front of it, and so looking at the tulips through it to the mirrors, you get the impression that there are dozens of flowers, when in fact there's only sort of 20 or something. If people can't afford enough tulips or can't find enough high quality tulips, then of course they are valuable. And so, to talk about the tulip mania in its beginnings, I mean, we need to stress this point. At its root, it was a real trade. There were a small number of people, 20 or 50 of them, who competed to grow the most beautiful tulips and would genuinely pay huge sums of money for them. But that was the only group in the history of the tulip mania who actively wanted to plant and admire flowers. And the peculiar thing about the trade as it grew was that it branched out from there to people who had no interest in growing flowers and saw the tulip as a sort of commodity, something which had value, but was not of value for itself, but was of value because of the rareness that it represented.
So if that's the richest people and their skilled gardeners there, sort of who comes along after them? Who's the next people piling into this? And as you say, maybe with not so much interest in the flowers themselves.
Well, I mean, the thing we have to say is this. This trade is entirely self-contained. I mean, throughout the whole period that we now think of as the period of the Dutch Tulip Mania, which begins sort of in the 1620s, but really focuses most in the period 1633 to 37, with a very strong focus on actually just the autumn of 1636 and the spring of 1637. That was the real mania period. Then the people who are buying and selling tulips in that period have nothing whatsoever, actually, to do with the regents. And the regents go on buying and selling their own flowers by themselves, completely oblivious, in a sense, to what's going on elsewhere. So the sorts of flowers that are being bought and sold are not the absolute finest, but the best that are available. And I mean, I suppose to explain why that might be of interest to anybody, we need to talk a bit about the Dutch Golden Age, and the development of the Dutch economy. And the key point here is rather a peculiar one. It sort of puzzled me when I came to write the book. I mean, the Dutch are the inventors of the modern economy. You know, the idea of a stock market, the idea of stocks and shares, the idea of futures contracts, all of those things were invented by the Dutch. And they had a stock market in a bourse in Amsterdam from 1612 or 1614. The tulip was not one of the products that was traded on the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, to be clear. They would trade spices and timber and commodities generally. The tulip trade, as it grew up, was a sort of weird parallel of what went on in the actual Dutch stock market with different sorts of commodities because, you know, spices were expensive and monopolized by these rich merchants. So, I mean, you're dealing with an economy which is booming and a country which, you know, much as I'm skeptical about sort of Reagan-style trickle-down economics, a certain amount of wealth inevitably did trickle down from the very richest to the very poorest. So the Dutch poor were not as poor as everybody else's poor. And what made the Dutch sort of unique in that sense is that, you know, in this period, they are probably the only country in Europe where some of the poor have actual savings. And yet, you know, there's nothing to do with that money because no banks exist. There's no sort of concept that you could go along to a branch of a local commercial bank, open an account, have someone pay you interest on your savings. You would normally keep your savings in a sock stuffed under the mattress and hope it wasn't stolen. So what seems to have happened, I think, is that some Dutch people noticed this trade, this, you know, that people gossiped about the amount of love that the regents had for their flower gardens and the amount of money that they were willing to spend. And it just seemed like an idea to potentially tap into that because, you know, one of the things we have to bear in mind is that, you know, to make a living in those days, if you weren't one of the elite, was a tremendously tough business. We can see this by looking at some of the laws that Amsterdam passed. For example, they had a law that said if you were a blacksmith, you were forbidden by law from starting work before 4 o'clock in the morning because your banging and crashing would disturb your neighbour. But, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning till midnight was totally fine. And, you know, I mean, typically people had to work ludicrously long hours to earn a living as a blacksmith to bring in those 300 guilders. You might well have to work 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, banging away at lumps of molten metal. It's a very tough life. If, on the other hand, you could buy a tulip bulb, stick it in the ground and sit back for 6 months, wait for it to flower, and it somehow magically increased in value, that's a very attractive option compared to banging bits of hot metal for 12 hours a day. And I think that the attraction of the tulip is partly based in the fact that it doesn't cost much labour. The second thing that we need to say about this is that, you know, it's very easy for us to look back on the tulip mania or any financial bubble from our sort of elevated position here in 2022 and say, but couldn't they see that, you know, disaster is inevitably going to follow, that this is a bubble, that bubbles always burst, that you know, what goes up must come down? And the answer to that in this particular case is, well, not really, because this is the first time it's ever happened anywhere. And what you have with the tulip, in all of these sort of no doubt distorted and perhaps exaggerated stories that sort of begin to circulate in Holland in the 1620s, is a commodity that only ever seems to go up in value, and in fact does that consistently for 10 years. It's not that stupid in that sense to suggest that you might want to invest in flowers. And there's no obvious reason, people didn't understand economics at all well then, even the people running the economy didn't, as to assume that they would necessarily be a crash.
It was like almost a parody of the stock market because they all got drunk together in the pubs and they traded it much like you might have traded it. And they used the same techniques and
they were trying to. They were, you know, I mean, they thought this was the way it was done, I guess. And they were trying to, not parody, but copy the stock market. So yes, I mean, they would form little clubs of people who would get together on a regular basis to trade. And, you know, I mean, they didn't own a stock market. In fact, even in the beginnings of the Dutch stock market, they used to meet in the local church before it was actually built. So it wasn't that unusual, but they would meet in the back room of pubs. And they would meet every day or every week. I mean, it started off every week and it got to become daily, and they would trade tulips. And every time that they did a trade, yes, you're right. I mean, they would toast that trade in a, you know, with a round of beer or a round of wine. And obviously, therefore, a lot of the Dutch tulip trading was done in a sort of alcoholic haze. And clearly that would have had an impact on people's levels of confidence and bravado and so on. And I'm sure that did stoke the mania. But at the beginning, there was a certain amount of logic to it. I mean, and one of the controversies that exists here, I mean, and I as a historian have a sort of a foot in one camp here, is that, you know, while historians are quite happy to look at this as a mania, as a wild piece of speculation, as an economic bubble, there are plenty of economists who fundamentally, I mean, economic theory doesn't really deal very well with bubbles because, of course, the basic rule of economics is that, you know, transactions should be rational and to maximize profit. And so there's a whole load of economists who are trying to sort of suggest that there's something fundamentally commonsensical about trading tulip bulbs. And, you know, what I would say to that group is that, you know, you have to look at what sort of bulbs are being traded. And going back to our previous point, I mean, you know, the really good ones are rare. I mean, the really good ones are not obtainable. The almost really good ones are incredibly rare. And so what happens, as you know, is you get a cycle of prices. They start going up. And so, you know, people are attracted to join these tulip clubs by the fact that the prices are rising. But, you know, when they arrive, they normally sort of liquidate whatever property that they can easily do to make some money to start speculating. So, I mean, classically, one of the groups who came into this trade were the weavers. And the weavers would mortgage their looms in order to raise some capital. They come and start dealing in the tulip clubs. So they come and want to buy some brilliant tulip bulbs and find that they couldn't afford them. And so, of course, they then go down to the next level of quality below that. And, you know, by the time you get to this sort of mania phase of the mania in 1636, people are starting to deal not in individual bulbs, but in sort of, you know, large parcels of very inferior bulbs, ones that are, you know, simply like the ones in Tian Shan Mountains. They're just unicolored tulips, and they come in sort of pounds of, in baskets. And so, you know, the whole of the available sort of tulip stock of the Netherlands, in a sense, becomes involved in this trade.
But it's not just the physical bulbs they start trading, is it? They have this brilliant idea that they'll trade, well, you plant the tulip and it doesn't flower until sometime in the future. So let's write down in a bit of paper,
yes,
what this tulip is going to be. And now let's, instead of trading the tulip bulb, let's trade the bit of paper.
Yes. And that's where the sort of, you know, the contract side, the futures side of it comes in. I should probably explain that a little bit. I mean, this is what makes the mania possible. I mean, there's an inhibitory factor built into tulip trading before this. As you say, you can only trade the tulips for the few months of the year that the bulbs are above ground. One of the things that have happened, you know, over the course of this history we talked about a bit earlier, where professional gardeners come into this, is that people have worked out that if you lift the tulip bulb out of the ground and keep it there for a few months and then plant it again in the autumn, it grows back stronger. And so there would be a period after the tulip has flowered and the flowers have all sort of fallen off. Then you lift the tulip bulb and there's 3 or 4 months and you can trade that tulip. But then at the end of that, you plant them again. Trade dries up for another 6 or 8 months. And as you say, I mean, ultimately, if you're trying to make a living as a tulip trader, that's a fairly unsatisfactory situation. And yes, what happened was you started to get the trade in promissory notes, where somebody would have a bit of paper saying, I own a tulip bulb that's this sort and it's planted in this guy's garden at this spot. And by giving you this bit of paper, I'm transferring my ownership to you. Now, I mean, that in itself is highly problematic. I mean, there's no way of telling the truth about that. I mean, I guess you could potentially get the gardener to swear to that. But I mean, I already mentioned that one of the peculiarities of the tulip is you might bury an admiral de Man and, you know, 6 months later, a completely different looking tulip is going to pop up, which is bound to cause disputes because, you know, some people will say, well, that's just the tulip being the tulip. And others will say, you're deceiving me. I paid this high amount of money for an admiral de Man and I got something much less valuable. So that in itself causes problems. The second thing that happened was, I mean, again, this is a product of the fact that people cannot afford it. And, you know, I mean, in this sense, I mean, perhaps we can talk about this a bit more in some depth later, there are some quite interesting parallels with the modern cryptocurrency, where you start off trading in Bitcoin, and then eventually you can't afford a whole Bitcoin, so you have to own a bit of a Bitcoin. And the same thing happened with the tulips. So these promissory notes would be, you know, phrased in the sense of, you know, so many aces, and aces are like a fraction of a gram. And so you'd also be sort of betting on two things. I mean, you've got this tulip bulb, you're kind of betting that it's going to turn out to be the same or more valuable sort of tulip when it flowers, but you're also betting on how much it's going to grow while it's under the ground. And, you know, tulips might grow a bit or a lot. And if you lift a tulip that's sort of doubled in weight, then you've doubled your money. Or if you bet on how many offsets it's going to have, it might have one offset or it might have three.
So tulips are being priced by the pound or by the ace, I guess.
Yes. And so you know, I mean, the point is that the trade is becoming more risky and more speculative and more mad, ultimately, as this trade goes on. And so, yes, I mean, the idea of selling sort of futures contracts where you're betting on how much the bulb will weigh when it comes out of the ground is very similar, and deliberately so, to the way in which the people down at the Amsterdam Stock Exchange are betting on when this latest cargo of spice might come in and how much the pepper on it will weigh, that type of thing. Very, very comparable.
And I guess the shrewdest dealers in the tulip market turned out to be some young children, the orphans of, was it Wouter Winkel?
Well, if you can call them sort of deliberately doing this. I mean, you know, this is one of the sort of set pieces of the tulip saga. And it's, in a sense, it's just because the evidence happens to have survived. But Wouter Winkel was a tulip trader who actually owned quite a large number of very valuable tulips planted in various gardens. And he died. His wife had predeceased him. So he had like 13 children. His 13 children became wards of state. This was something else that the Netherlands did better than anybody else at that time, that the state would actually get together and kind of look after orphans by liquidating their parents' assets and giving them the money. Now, in the case of Wouter Winkel, the main assets he possessed were these tulips, and there was an auction of these bulbs at Alkmaar in 1636, and people came from all over the Netherlands to see this fabled collection and bid on them. And in the aftermath of the auction, a pamphlet, a little one-sheet pamphlet, was published listing the prices. And this is one of the prime sources we have. I mean, the actual prices paid for tulips often weren't written down or recorded terribly well, and sometimes we guess they're probably exaggerated. But this auction record seems to be reasonably authentic and gives us the best idea of how many, you know, sort of thousands of guilders were being bid for these plants. And so, you know, I mean, we've reached the point at this stage where, you know, tulip bulbs are changing hands for the price of a house in Amsterdam. I mean, it's that sort of level of value. And they've gone up from, you know, a few guilders there for sort of thousands of guilders. And notionally, some people have become extremely wealthy. Wouter Winkel is an example of that. But there is an inbuilt, baked-in problem with all of this, and that is that, you know, there comes a day when all of these contracts have to be settled. And that is the day when the bulbs are lifted from the ground. And so priced into this speculation is the knowledge that every year there is a sort of reckoning where you don't want to be left holding some future contracts that turn out to be worth less than you think they're being worth. And so, you know, this is really, I think, where the sort of fuel to the final mania stage sort of comes from, this sort of frantic buying and selling that builds up as you're trying to get rid of, you know, some liabilities, acquire other things that you think might be less risky liabilities. And, you know, everybody involved in the market, I mean, there's no such thing as a sort of like a bear group and a bull group. And some people own tulips and some people who don't own tulips. Everybody kind of owns tulips and also owes other people for tulips. And there's a sort of, you know, balance there that, you know, your incomings, your outgoings, your responsibilities, but your creditors kind of have a certain sort of inbuilt balance.
So you're saying that basically, by and large, nobody is cashing out?
Correct. I mean, the Wouter Winkel one is a good example of a very rare event where that seems to have happened, but that happened because he died. And in fact, it's still, you know, highly uncertain whether or not all of those bids were actually paid for. I mean, there's no record that people ponied up their thousands of guilders on the spot. And, you know, this auction took place only a few days before the final collapse in prices. So it's possibly a little bit optimistic to think that these poor orphans actually got the gigantic fortune that theoretically they were due, because they got caught up in the crash along with everybody else. But yes, I mean, you have this situation where more and more people have been brought into the market, more and more people have been seduced by the lure of the ever-rising prices, more and more people have auctioned or pawned their possessions, and they're coming in and they're trying to buy tulips. And ultimately, I think, you know, the thing that sort of causes the crash is that you approach this lifting day at a point where the supply in tulips basically dries up, and you reach the point where even a reasonably wealthy newcomer to the market who's auctioned everything they've got can't afford even the cheapest tulips. And at that point, the sort of supply of new money coming into the market cuts off. and the whole market is then choked with a, constantly rising prices cannot be supported by a fixed amount of capital fundamentally. And so that's how the scene gets set for the disaster of the actual crash.
So just tell us, how does, is it a long drawn out process, like, I don't know, like the 1930s great crash, or?
Well, no, I mean, on the contrary, I mean, the Wall Street crash is a fascinating parallel. I mean, to give people some idea, the price of shares, the share index in the United States, the crash begins in 1929, and over the next 2 years, I think the value of the shares goes down by about two-thirds on average in total. In the case of the tulip making, the price of tulips went down by 99% in 6 weeks. So it is by several magnitudes, a vastly more destructive crash. And of course, it's quite commonplace to read that, this must have caused the collapse of the entire Dutch economy. And that actually isn't the case for the reason I mentioned earlier, which is that the tulip trade is like insulated from the real economy. It's a bunch of working class people in pubs playing with money, playing with commodities. And they don't have anything to do really with the really rich people who are, as I said, in some cases, happily going and buying and selling these super rare tulip bulbs that really exist, and they really want to plant them. I mean, the problem with the tulip traders, of course, is they had absolutely no interest in planting these bulbs, and in fact, usually had no gardens to plant them. And one of the reasons why the tulip was so popular, I should have mentioned this earlier, perhaps, in the Netherlands, was that it was a notoriously drab country. I mean, this is before the Dutch had evolved the technology to drain all their swamps. And, most of it was very low-lying and made of sort of sandy soil where it doesn't grow very much. And, notoriously, an English visitor to the place actually published a pamphlet in which he labelled the entire Netherlands as, a universal quagmire, the buttock of the world. So there was a sort of, a desire for colour in that country, but most poor people did not have a garden or even plant pots to grow these things in. Nobody wants to grow the tulips except for the regents with their fancy country houses. And this is the basic problem of the tulip mania. It is merely a commodity. The fact that it's a tulip is, in a sense, meaningless. It's just something which can be bought and sold and which appears to have value and appears to be adding value. And so, yes, I mean, the panic over the lifting time is partly because, well, I don't care if this tulip goes back in the ground or not. All I want is to cash out and make some money. And I'm getting a bit concerned now that, maybe that's going to be problematic. What actually happened then? I mean, there must have been, we don't really know because the sources just don't exist, but there must have been some sort of feeling as people realised that, people were not joining their tulip trading circles and fresh money wasn't coming in. There must have been some concern about how this was all going to end up because, the actual tilting point, I mean, at least according to the pamphlets that were published at the time, I should stress that, the pamphlets we're talking about are kind of, moralistic religious pamphlets, which may exaggerate somewhat. They're not sort of newspaper reports or anything like that. Newspapers didn't exist in the Netherlands in 1637. But according to the moralistic pamphlets, what happened was very straightforward. There was an auction of a basic basket of bulbs that in a tulip tavern club in Haarlem, which is the second city in the Netherlands, and it's just down the road from Amsterdam. And, in normal times, this would have, every time you auction one of these baskets, it would set a new record price. That had always happened. That was the characteristic of these clubs, was that the price always went up. And this time the auction failed, and people wouldn't bid up the price to greater than the previous price, and in fact it failed to reach its sort of reserve price. And at that point, you can imagine, essentially, everyone looking at each other saying, well, I don't know what's supposed to happen next. I mean, this has not happened before. There was a panic. People literally ran out of this tavern down to their mates in the next tavern to say, this unprecedented thing has happened. Sell, 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 I suppose. And that's how the price collapse began. I mean, because of lack of communications, it wasn't instantaneous. I mean, it took a few days for the news to get around the Netherlands. But, within that very short period, as I said, just a couple of weeks, essentially, people who wanted to buy tulip bulbs ceased to exist. People who wanted to sell tulip bulbs were everywhere, but nobody would buy them from them. And so you have this sort of notional collapse in prices of something which only a small-ish, I mean, maybe a few thousand people are buying and selling, which causes so much notice to be paid to the tulip trade and then the publication. Moralistic pamphlets, but it's not connected to the Dutch economy, and it doesn't in fact cause a crash of the Dutch economy. What it does do is it causes a huge amount of trouble for a small number of people who've been foolish, as it turns out. And the way in which all this resolved is quite fascinating because, again, I mean, had it been hashed out properly as it's supposed to be, it would have been a hideous, horrible, expensive mess. because as I mentioned earlier, I mean, most of the people involved in these tulip clubs are clutching these handfuls of promissory notes, and at the same time, they owe various other things that other people have got their promissory notes. And, you know, setting out the fundamental detail of each of these contracts, because, I mean, they're being passed on from person to person. You know, you buy a tulip and you sell it on the same day. And in one day in one of these tulip clubs, it might be bought or sold 8 or 10 times, with people kind of scribbling signatures in increasingly small spaces left at the bottom of these tiny scraps of paper. Working out who owed what to who would have been a nightmare. And the interesting thing about the tulip mania is that, you know, it doesn't seem to have had a huge impact, and that is because of the way that the Dutch state sought to deal with it. The Dutch state basically dealt with it by sort of, you know, pretending the problem didn't exist. I mean, the original idea was that, you know, the any legal case that was brought would be brought to the sort of town council. The town councils refused to hear them and punted it up to the provincial parliament, who refused to hear it and punted it up to the national parliament, the States General, who then sort of sent it back down to the towns again. And it was sort of went round in a circle a couple of times. And ultimately, most of the provinces passed the laws, basically making it illegal to pursue a claim for a tulip-related loss or gain. And so that seems actually, I mean, coincidence. I mean, I don't think it was done deliberately. It was just done to stop choking up the court system, stop the rich people having to deal with all of these sort of vagrants demanding money. But what actually happened was that, you know, it fundamentally meant that most people ended up in a situation where they're, you know, they couldn't claim money, but then on the other hand, nobody could claim money from them. So they were just back to where they started, but without a loom. So, I mean, they were marginally worse off. They had to find some way of, you know, getting a higher purchase arrangement to recover their loom from the pawnbrokers. But that's a relatively small amount of money compared to, you know, 5,000 rich people all going bankrupt simultaneously, which would have had an impact on the Dutch economy. And so, you know, the mania, in a sense, sort of petered out in a really rather undramatic way for something that had been such a dramatic episode.
And why do we remember tulip mania? Because we absolutely do remember it. And yet, as you say, it's all gone in a flash, and it doesn't crash. It doesn't, you know, the Dutch economy continues to motor. So why is it still such a...
Yes, that's a very good question. I mean, you know, a couple of things. I mean, it is very symbolic, and it's very dramatic, and it's surrounding something which is very beautiful. I mean, that's a peculiar combination. So, you know, Bitcoin isn't beautiful.
Mm.
Gold, I suppose some people find it's beautiful, but it's still, you know, sort of a lump. I mean, there's something special about the tulip, you know. I mean, from that point of view, it is rare, it is remarkable. And people remember it because it's such a bizarre thing that the world's first financial bubble should involve something as strange as a flower and not gold or something which has obvious and intrinsic value. So there's, you know, that's the aspect of it. I think, to be honest, I mean, a lot of it is also connected with the myths. You know, if some killjoy historian like me is sitting around saying it didn't really matter that much, it would have perhaps become less famous. But, of course, most people thought it did matter. One of the most sort of, you know, the biggest contributions to all of this was a mid-19th century Victorian journalist called Charles Mackay, who wrote a book called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds.
Right.
And this is one of these, it's one of these books that, you know, I mean, at least in sort of popular lore, you know, New York investment banks used to hand out to their sort of wet behind the ears new brokers to sort of warn them of things like bubbles. I'm not sure whether that ever happened. It's a massive book. It's about 1,500 pages long. I mean, it doesn't hurt. I mean, I'm sure it matters, actually. The tulip chapter is the shortest one in it. This book has like 150 pages on trends in beards and 8 pages on the tulip mania. Well, you can guess which chapter most people read. And that would have made a big difference as well. It was a big bestseller, but the tulip chapter is by far the most successful. I mean, most of the stories that Mackay tells are probably not true. I mean, his most famous anecdote is about this, you know, this sailor who's been out sailing the world for a couple of years, totally oblivious to the fact that tulips are now the big thing, comes home and sits down on the wharf in Amsterdam, gets off his ship after 18 months, and, you know, he wants some food. And, you know, so he's sitting next to a guy who, as far as he can see, is eating some sort of raw onion. So he just sort of surreptitiously reaches over and grabs the guy's raw onion and eats it. And of course, it's the most valuable tulip bulb in Amsterdam. That's one of the stories that Mackay tells. And yeah, I mean, other people have done something similar. I mean, there's the famous Alexander Dumas story, The Black Tulip, which is based on a very similar idea and set in the tulip mania period. I mean, interestingly enough, actually, I mean, it's not possible for a flower to be black. Genetically speaking, it has to be a very, very dark purple is the closest you can get. But, I mean, again, the idea is it's the most unique, the most valuable, therefore, tulip bulb that's at the centre of this sort of romantic story that Dumas spins. So, I mean, it's a symbolic story, and it's an unusual story. And it's that combination, I think, that makes us think about it. But fundamentally, and most importantly, it's the first story. It's the earliest real known financial bubble. And in that sense, it's sort of like the bubble, which we all have to learn lessons from. And certainly that's how economists and economic historians have written about it.
But the tulip carries on, and carries on being popular, doesn't it, in the Ottoman Empire? I think some of the later, less successful sultans seem to spend quite a lot of their time alone with their tulips.
Well, yes. And you know, I mean, they, again, have been insulated from the tulip mania, and they are rich people with paradise gardens. Without wanting to go off on such a tangent that we end up with an entirely different podcast, the interesting thing that happened in the Ottoman Empire was a change in the way in which the succession was. The Ottomans became famous for this lunatically ruthless succession system. They had the sort of fratricidal system, it's called. The Sultan would have like 20 sons, and they'd all be posted around various bits of the empire as local governors. And when the Sultan died, there'd be a sort of mad race between these 24 sons to make it back to the capital, seize control, get hold of the army. And then, you know, in order to cement their power, they would kill all their brothers. This was mandated by law. I mean, it wasn't just one wanted to do it. It was like the way it was done. Once you had established control, you would send off a group of assassins, and they would tour around and wipe out all of these people, including sort of babes in arms. They'd be strangled with a silk bowstring. I mean, it was a decent death by Ottoman standards to be strangled with a silk bowstring. At the turn of the 17th century, Ahmed II decided that he loved his children much too much to allow them all to go and kill each other after his death. And he introduced a second system, which is called the cage system, the kafas, where rather than sending his sons off to the far reaches of the empire to learn how to actually rule, they were all locked up in this suite of rooms in the Topkapi Palace in Istanbul, in Constantinople. And every time the Sultan died, the officials would sort of go into this place and choose somebody to be the next Sultan. And this poor guy had spent 40 years doing macrame. That was their main part, you know, their main occupation inside this chamber of rooms. So, I mean, you know, while the fratricidal system was obviously deeply unpleasant, it certainly did succeed in producing extremely ruthless, successful, warlike rulers, whereas the cage system produces, you know, a succession of absolute fools. And that's one of the reasons for the decline and fall of the Ottoman Empire, actually. But in this place, in the palace, I mean, one of the few things you could do was admire the beautiful tulip gardens in the palace. And so, yes, I mean, Ottoman sultans did continue to adore the tulip. And Ahmed III, who ruled in the 1730s, 1720s, was the most famous tulip maniac of all time. And, you know, absolutely, he valued tulips in the way they're meant to be valued, for their actual beauty and their actual value to him was as sort of symbols of, you know, sort of God's munificence. And yes, I mean, there was a sort of second flourishing of the tulip in the Ottoman Empire 100 years or so after the Dutch tulip mania, where Ahmed would hold, you know, annual tulip festivals, and he'd have tortoises wandering around his tulip gardens with candles stuck on their backs to illuminate the tulips, and everybody would sort of, you know, live a sort of indulgent and beautiful life. It was a very sort of Brighton Revisited type of reign, really, Ahmed III's, and the tulip was at the centre of it. So, yes, I mean, it, you know, it's continued. I mean, the Dutch are still the world's biggest manufacturers, growers, I should say, probably, of tulips today. I mean, they grow and export millions and millions and millions of the things. So it's always been there. But they've never had a second tulip mania. But they've learned that lesson.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Mike Dash, that was terrific. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's the end of today's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, then I have a big favour to ask. I don't look to make any money from the podcast. There's no advertising or anything like that. I just do this because I enjoy speaking to the guests, and, you know, I'm keen for them to get as big an audience as possible, because I think, you know, they are really, really good people. So if you could share it on whatever social media channel you use, tweet it out, whatever it is, and even better, if you could leave a review on iTunes, that would be absolutely fantastic. Anyway, goodbye for now.